It's fair season, and that means the quest for blue ribbons is on. This hour, we'll get an insider's view of the vegetable, fruit, and flower competitions at the Iowa State Fair. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Iowa State University Extension horticulturists Richard Giron and Cindy Haynes will be here. They have been busy judging contests at the Iowa State Fair. And today, we'll find out what the judges are looking for when they award that coveted first place ribbon. Later in the hour, Richard and Cindy will answer your questions about the things you'd like to grow or grow better. 866-780-9100. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. The State Fair opened yesterday, and if you visit the Horticulture Building, you can not only see beautiful gardens, but some really impressive fruit, vegetable, and flower specimens. Richard Giron is Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Expert. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Cindy Haynes is also here, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State. Hello, Cindy.
Good morning.
And they are both seasoned veteran judges at the Iowa State Fair. Thank you both for being here today. Have you already been down judging this year?
Cindy has. I haven't.
I was there yesterday.
And what were you judging yesterday, Cindy?
Vegetables for FFA.
Oh, nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. Well, and I see that right now, according to the schedule, you are missing the weed identification contest to be here today.
And that's okay.
Yeah, that's okay. We're not experts there.
Well,
we just pull them.
Right. There are dozens of different contests mm-hmm. at the Iowa State Fair, and I'm sure that you've been asked to judge a lot of them over the years. When you're asked to judge in a specific category, what do you have to do to prepare?
Not really much of anything. It's basically just kind of having an idea of what you expect to be as far as the ideal fruit or vegetable. What should it look like as far as ideal? Does it basically fit the rules as far as what's supposed to be there? When they say five, it should be five or something, not six or four. And when you look at them, are they basically blemish-free? And that's important as far as quality. Are they uniform as far as size? You don't want something where they want five of, let's say, tomatoes, and you have four that are quite large and then a small one. They're not uniform. So you're looking for basically uniformity, no blemishes, and then you look at quality. And that's kind of in the eye of the beholder as far as what you think is ideal. And so you kind of base it on, for example, maybe the variety or cultivar. How big should it really be? Is it too big? Is it too small? That type of thing.
But the judges have some experience in that as well. They know what the different cultivars should look like, or many of the different cultivars look like. So we know Green Zebra is going to be a green tomato when it's ripe versus, you know, an orange one or a red one. So there is a lot of background knowledge that you kind of have to come in with, and then you just kind of follow those guidelines.
How many judges per contest?
It depends upon whether it's 4-H, FFA, the open division. We usually do it in pairs. And so that takes out some of the subjectivity because we kind of compare what we like.
And we have to agree.
We have to agree. So that kind of takes care of that a little bit.
So we question each other right. All the time.
Yeah. Any disputes, heated disputes?
Oh, yeah. not heated, but we will kind of discuss things, yes. So
right.
And I will defer to Cindy on okra. She knows okra.
And I will defer to Richard, like on cabbage. So, yeah, so we kind of know where maybe our expertise is.
Now, of course, if somebody's going to enter the Iowa State Fair with one of their vegetables or mm-hmm. in the fruit category, and they're going to bring the best from their garden.
Right.
So you see a lot of blemish-free uniform fruit or vegetable offerings probably.
Right. But oftentimes you can, if you look carefully, you'll find something that maybe if you turn it over and look at it very closely, it's there, and maybe they put it on the plate so that you didn't see it, but you kind of look at it and you see it, and that's just one of those points.
All right, so you are allowed to touch,
absolutely,
turn things over.
We do.
We're just not allowed to taste anything usually.
Well, I was going to ask that because, of course, mm-hmm, for most of us, the delicious taste of fresh garden produce, mm-hmm, is why we put in all of the effort into growing it, but you, mm-hmm, can't taste it.
Nope.
We can't taste it, but, you know, and that makes it hard for, like, watermelon because you don't know exact ripeness until you actually cut it open, but... but yeah, they don't look good on the plate if they have a bite out of them. So it's an okay thing.
Well, and I do know that there is a best tasting
tomato right,
competition that's coming up on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Do you get to judge that?
I don't. I know a couple of the people who have before in the past. Richard, have you ever judged that one?
I have not, no.
Okay. Yeah,
that sounds like a pretty good gig.
It's a small group that does that.
It's a fun one. So it's a fun one to
absolutely
watch.
Absolutely. I can imagine that after a while, tomatoes would all start to taste the same, but...
I don't know.
That's why they haven't asked me to judge it.
Right. Actually, you would make a pretty good judge. I think there's a lot of them that taste very different. They usually get a wide range of diversity of tomatoes there. So that's what's the amazing part about it.
So with the fruits and vegetables, I think we all kind of have an idea of what we're going to see. But mm-hmm, what about some of the other horticultural contests? Can you give me an idea of the variety?
Well, there is one where they have some of the oddities, where you have maybe a potato that has knobs on it that may resemble an animal or whatever, or they have these forked carrots. So they have a category where they can bring, if they have some really unusual fruit or vegetables, they can bring those in that category. And then they have the largest category where they have huge, like, cabbages.
The jumbos,
maybe squash. Based strictly on size.
And weight.
So mm-hmm, if you have something that's really maybe over mature, but it's huge, you can put it in that category. And then they have like the heirloom tomatoes, where they have just heirloom varieties on
there. Heirloom vegetables, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So different categories.
And then also in the agriculture building at the Iowa State Fair are the flowers. And they have several different rotations of different types of flowers. The FFA flowers were there for judging. Yesterday, I know they have the dahlias that are there at the end of the show, and then there's roses that are in between.
Glads.
So there's a lot of, and that amazes me because even if it's the dahlias or the glads or the roses, you see the diversity of colors, shapes, and sizes all within that one species.
Absolutely. I've seen the rose competition mm-hmm before, and it was just stunning and
yes,
beautiful. But it also strikes me how difficult it is to, and I mean, some people are very serious about these competitions.
We cannot
overstate that enough. The fact that they've been able to produce something that is at its peak mm-hmm during the Iowa State Fair. And some people work very hard to make sure that they can get that done.
That rose might be on drip irrigation. It might have been sprayed. It might be shaded. You know, it might even, the things that you do to make sure that you have that perfect rose or glad or dahlia for the State Fair is absolutely amazing.
And a lot of those flowers, when they travel to the fair, mm-hmm, I suspect they're refrigerated. So that they, at least they're not aging during the travel.
Right. They're not declining. And they're very well protected so that they're not bumping or bruising or, yes, it's a whole system. It's an incredible system. And it makes for an incredibly beautiful display.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned how the flowers or how the crops might have been grown. That's not something that as a judge you have any information about, right?
No.
We know the cultivar, and that's really it. Even the name of the person is covered up, so we don't even know what city or town that it was grown in Iowa. We only know that cultivar name and that it's in the peppers class or the tomatoes class or division. And then it's compared to everything else that's there.
Have you had people whose vegetables or whatever they've entered into the contest, have you had people there watching you judge their vegetables?
Yes, absolutely. They get in the balcony and they can look down and see us. Yeah, so they kind of watch.
And we've even had a few who actually ask us some questions afterwards. What are you looking for? Why did you choose this one over this one?
Right.
So, and we do our best to answer those questions if possible. And then we usually don't hang around too long after judging. So I will admit that, you know, that's usually lunchtime. We're tired of being on our feet. So
sure, yeah. Sure. And there's some food available at the fair.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
some
yes.
Fair.
Some food. Not too far. On a stick. Yeah.
Right. So what do you enjoy about judging these competitions?
I enjoy just looking at the diversity of different... I learn a lot by looking at the diversity of hot peppers and amazed at, you know, the really long, large ones I'm having to judge against these teeny tiny ones, or the quality of what actually comes to the exhibits or the displays, because some of them are absolutely amazing. So the slicing tomatoes that I judged yesterday, there were three beautiful, almost perfect slicing tomatoes, perfect ripeness, perfect red, no blemishes. All three of them looked like they were carbon copies of each other. And I was like, oh, if I could just take one of these home. Why do I never see this in the grocery store? So it's wonderful to kind of have that excitement and enthusiasm and look at all those different vegetables.
And do you have commercial growers who are competing with home garden growers, or are there restrictions about that?
That's mainly maybe in the fruit, like for the apples. You may have commercial growers there and just homeowners as far as apples.
I think in the open class, you can,
right, you
anyone
can have some too.
Anyone can you know, exhibit or display or put in the contest. So that's, it's not really, you know, it could be.
We don't know who it is.
We don't know. So it could be commercial versus regular consumers. The other two things that we judge in vegetables are FFA and 4-H, and those are the kids. And then they are restricted to just FFA members or 4-H members.
Of course, if it's a commercial grower, and I've seen this mm-hmm. in the apple competitions, although it's a terrible time of year to have an apple mm-hmm. competition right
is.
Now because all the best apples are yet to come.
Right.
But it can be a big boon for a grower to win at the state fair. That's something that they
right.
can really advertise and,
right.
and tell their customers about. What do you think's in it for the individual? Why do you think this is important to people?
Just for the fun of it.
For the ribbons.
For the ribbons of pride.
To show them yeah. off. And yeah, it's that reward for doing a good job all summer growing that plant.
Have either one of you ever entered a fair contest, either as a kid or as an adult?
I have not.
Well, the Louisiana State Fair is not anything kind of like the Iowa State Fair. So, yes, I didn't even consider it then as a kid. And then the other things that I could enter are at the Iowa State Fair would be like the cooking or the quilting, and I am not of that caliber. I can tell you right now.
I saw I went through all the quilts yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
Incredible work.
Yes.
Incredible
yes.
work up there.
Yes. And I realize I will never get there, and that's okay.
Right, but they're fun to see.
They are fun.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. With me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Expert, and you are welcome to join the conversation with your questions about the plants in your life. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. With me, Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Expert, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. They are here to answer your questions. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And a lot of people already on the phones. We'll start with Frida in Milton. Hi, Frida.
Hi, Charity. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I love your program. You helped me already a couple times. I have a question. This is the first year I'm growing Brussels sprouts. Now, somebody told me when it gets to a certain height or when the fruit comes on, I'm supposed to take the bottom leaves off. Is that correct?
Well, there's debate on that as far as how to harvest them. Some people, when they harvest the little sprouts, they also take off the leaf at the same time. Other people leave it on. So it's really up to you.
Okay, but the fruit is really not ready until fall. I mean, they're now the size of maybe like a cherry, I want to say.
Right. Typically, the Brussels sprouts typically does best as a fall crop. So ideally, you plant it in early to midsummer. It then matures in October, early November, and you simply harvest the sprouts as they get to the right size.
Okay, thank you. And I also was growing kale, and I've been enjoying, this is the first year I'm enjoying kale. Thank you so much for expertise, and you all have a safe day.
Thank you. Bye. Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Frida. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Lori is up next in Columbus Junction. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I went out one morning about 2 weeks ago, and every tree, every leaf on my birch tree was dead. They were all full of little holes. They were brown and falling off the tree. Do you have any idea why?
I would assume Japanese beetles. How big a tree is it?
It's probably 20 years old. It's a large tree.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the tree is okay. It can tolerate that. Japanese beetles like certain plants. They love linden trees, birch trees, elm trees, roses, grapevines, that type of thing. And when they attack a plant, if there are large numbers, they can essentially defoliate it. And what you see when you examine the foliage is most of the leaf is gone. And what they leave behind are the veins, because the veins are tougher tissue. And so they don't eat that, so you have this skeleton-type appearance to the foliage. The leaves, when they're badly damaged, turn brown and they fall off. But if it's a well-established tree, they can tolerate it. It's not a good thing, but they're okay, and they'll be fine next spring.
Okay, you said roses also?
Yep, they love roses.
Because one of the buds on my climbing rose bush was just covered with these black bugs, and I beat them off.
Okay.
But that the same thing, do you think?
Well, they're dark green with kind of a coppery sheen. That's what they look like.
Well, I just saw them. Maybe I mistook the color.
Yeah, and they tend to feed in groups, because apparently when they start to feed, they release a pheromone, and that attracts additional Japanese beetles. And so oftentimes you see them in groups.
A whole cluster.
Yeah. So, but fortunately, the Japanese beetles should be gone soon.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Lori. They've really disappeared in a lot of places already. So
I'm still seeing them in names, but their numbers are decreasing, definitely.
They're going.
Yes, they're going.
And they can't go fast enough.
No, they can't. Next up, Kurt in Des Moines. Hi, Kurt.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What's your question?
The question has to do with how to eradicate a so-called tree of paradise. I have, in the spring, I was able to cut out three of the trees or bushes or whatever they're called out of my garden, but one persisted and keeps coming back. And I tried to, last spring, dig it out manually, but found that to be very difficult.
Well, it sounds like you have the tree of heaven, and it is a tree. It's a very adaptable tree, will grow almost anywhere. It suckers, which is a very annoying habit. And so when you cut it off, it just simply suckers from the root somewhere else. And so controlling it is difficult. I think in this case, I would use the Roundup or glyphosate, where if you have a large sprout, if you can maybe cut it off, if you have a stump where you might drill some holes in the stump and then very, very carefully put some Roundup in those holes or on the surface. But this probably will be a project that may take a year or two, because it's going to try to survive as best it can. And so you have to destroy the entire root system, which may take a year or two.
Sounds good. I appreciate the advice. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Kurt. Next up, Paul in Norwalk. Hi, Paul.
Hello there.
Hi.
I built a raised bed for my wife's strawberry last year, and she planted some ever-bearing varieties. I don't know exactly which ones they are, but they've become infested by something.
that is affecting the flower, which means we either get a very small, misshapen fruit or virtually no fruit at all. Do you have an idea what that might be?
I would tend to think it might be an insect, possibly, like a tarnished plant bug, which might be stinging the small fruit, and therefore they do not develop like they normally do. They stay very small. They stay very seedy. So I'm guessing it might be that. That's only a guess, though, where it might be an insect. I think if it were a disease, it might turn soft or rot, but I think in this case it may be an insect like a tarnished plant bug, which is very, very hard to see. They're very small, and they're very hard to control, unfortunately, too.
Yeah, that's what I was afraid of.
So I would maybe look very, very closely, because you're going to have to look because they are quite small, and see if you do see like a tarnished plant bug. You might want to Google that and see what they look like.
Okay. I believe she has on occasion found like a small larvae type thing in one of the small fruits or misshapen fruits. Will they have a larvae stage that they'll deal with, or
not inside the fruit? No. So that would be something else possibly. So.
Okay. Well, we may have to take some pictures and maybe send it to the.
You could do that. Right, you could do that, where you take some photographs and send those to our entomology staff. Their email address is insects, which is plural, INSECTS, at IASTATE.edu.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Yep, good luck with that, Paul. How frustrating to build a raised bed
yes.
and then not get any produce out of it.
Right.
Very, very frustrating. 866-780-9100 is the number to call with your questions. You can also email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Cindy Haynes and Richard Geron are here today. And here's an email question from Tracy in Mason City. She says, if I remember correctly, Richard says that I need to, one, kill my creeping Charlie in August, two, apply a second application, then three, seed.
Well,
so she wants a refresher course.
Well, not exactly.
Okay.
If you have an area that is, let's say, strictly overrun by weeds, very little grass, then one strategy is to simply destroy everything in early to mid-August, and then overseed with grass seed in late August, early September. But if you have ground ivy growing in your grass, but there's still quite a bit of grass, then I would try to save the grass and kill the ground ivy. And so in that situation, I'd wait till late September and apply a broadleaf herbicide containing triclopyr, and then come back in another month, do it again a second time, and that should kill the ground ivy, but save the grass. So it all depends upon how bad the infestation is. If it's strictly weeds, then just destroy it, and then reseed in late August.
Okay, and you have been telling people all spring, all summer, seed in mid-August if you want to plant grass seed.
Right.
So
we're nearly there. Right, you can seed sometime between mid-August and mid-September.
All right, let's go back to the phones, 866-780-9100. Brian is on the line in North Liberty. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I have a pear tree and a couple pears, non-fruit bearing, just a flowering pear tree. And I noticed a few weeks ago that there was several limbs that are just brown and the leaves are completely dead, but the rest of the tree seems to be fine. And I had a white ABS tube around the base of it to protect it from animals, and I took that off and noticed that there's the main trunk, which is about 2 inches in diameter, and off of it, way at the base, there's a 1-inch sprout coming off that's, you know, as tall as the rest of the tree. I was wondering what I should do with that.
I would cut that off, because It may be coming from the rootstock. Those trees are propagated by grafting the desired variety onto a hardy rootstock. And the graft union is typically at ground level or slightly below, slightly above ground level. And sometimes the rootstock will send up a sprout. It will grow very rapidly and may be somewhat different than most of your tree as far as appearance. And so you don't want that to happen.
Okay.
And so if you see that, you want to immediately remove that, cut it off at the point of origin. As far as the dieback in the tree, how big are these dead branches? A foot? 3 feet?
Yeah, a foot or two.
Okay.
I think those are all coming off of the sprout.
Oh, they are.
Okay. I don't know. Yeah, I noticed my neighbor has the same type of tree, and his is, it's probably 20 feet from mine. And his has got the same thing, but his has got a lot more dieback in it. But his is a much larger tree.
I wonder,
mine's only a few years old.
Yeah, I wonder if it might be fire blight. Fire blight is a bacterial disease. It's not a fungus, but it's a bacterium. It does affect apples and pears. Both ornamental pears and edible pears. And basically it strikes the new growth and you see the leaves turn a dark brown, but they hang on the actual branch. And so the entire branch dies, the leaves turn a dark brown and they just hang there. And if your neighbor has an infected tree, it probably served as a source for your problem too. On that sprout. As far as controlling it, if it's just on the sprout, then I would simply remove that and get rid of it and watch your tree again next spring and summer for the fire blight possibly.
Okay.
There is no effective control as far as spraying. Fungicides are not effective. Typically what we do is if we have to, we prune out the affected shoots. And when we do so, we cut about 6 inches below the visible damage to make sure we're getting it. And we also have to disinfect the pruning shear after each cut. So it's kind of complicated.
All right, Brian, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Max in Esterville. Hi, Max. Oh, Max may not still be there. Max, are you here? All right, we'll move on to Don in Cedar Falls. Hi, Don. Don?
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
It's actually Dell.
Okay, Dell. Sorry about
that. I'm sorry. I'm a little slow to pick up.
No problem.
I have developed an infatuation with hollyhocks.
Oh, nice.
And I have several of them growing around my lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just about the end of their season. So a couple of questions. One is it all right now to cut them back to the crown or the base?
Yeah.
And of course the second is does it make any sense to try to salvage and repropagate any of those seeds?
Well, you should try and salvage some of those seeds and replant them. Hollyhocks, most of them, the big ones, are biennials. So the first year from seed they just produce vegetative growth, and the second year from seed is when they actually flower nicely. So you want to kind of harvest some of that seed so that you can scatter that around this year or next spring, if you want.
I have tried that and had little luck getting it to even germinate.
Yeah.
So what do you suggest?
What I might suggest is let Mother Nature do a little bit. It's going to scatter itself around as well. So as you're cutting those back, open up some seed and scatter some in the area that it was planted already, because we know that's a pretty good area. You know, that mother plant will probably die anyway, so there'll be some space there. And then I would just kind of water that in well, kind of mulch that over, that area over just a little bit so you know where, and then let Mother Nature take its course. If you want to harvest some of those seed and save for spring, then you might actually try starting those indoors about the time you start your tomatoes or peppers, and then try and plant those outside next spring.
Otherwise, just put them on the ground in the fall and see what comes up.
Yeah, see what comes up, because usually there's plenty of seed there. So even if only 50% come up, that may give you, sure, you know, more than a dozen plants.
And you would put just a light cover of mulch over the seed?
I would.
In the fall?
I would, yeah, after, just so I know where it is, and just a fine kind of mulch so that it's, like I said, I know that area. I'm going to check that area for hollyhocks coming up next year, and I'm not going to weed that area too heavily.
All right, Del, thanks a lot for your call. Let's slip in another email question before the break. This one's from Bob in Ames. I would like to know what veggies would be suitable for planting right now.
A lot of your leafy greens you could probably plant now. Some of those lettuce, spinach, and kale.
Kale, and maybe some radishes. Yeah.
All of these
basically cool season crops that would mature before a hard freeze.
So the things that you planted in early spring, it's time to start planting
those again. Right, even some beets and carrots.
Right, but look for that kind of quick turnaround crops. So, you know, that only the harvestable in about 60 days or less.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. With me, Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. They are here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's an email question from Doug in Des Moines. I planted a butterfly bush a couple of weeks ago, and I was told it might die in the location I chose. It's on the north-northwestern corner of the front of my house. Not much sun in the morning, but does get sun all afternoon. About a foot or so deep, the soil gets a bit of clay. My house is on a slight hill sloping towards the bush, and right after, there's a short, steep slope toward my neighbor's house. What do you think? Will my butterfly bush survive?
Butterfly bush. Now, that's a woody plant.
Herbaceous. Dies back to the ground.
It's a woody plant that dies back to the ground each winter. And some winters, it dies completely.
Depending on how cold it gets.
Right. I would prefer a sunny location in a well-drained soil. And so that may not be the ideal location. So if it does survive, I think I'd move it next spring. I wouldn't try doing it now, but maybe next spring.
Well, and one of the things that he might be able to do to protect it is just to mound up some mulch or some soil on top of that particular plant after, you know, it kind of dies back or after the ground or starts to freeze, so that you're protecting it just a little bit more.
So do you think it's the winter conditions that are the most, the greatest danger?
Yeah,
okay. Because it's so exposed right there.
And then if there's some heavy clay soil, then that's impacting root growth as well, because it likes a pretty well-drained soil.
And if it doesn't get enough sun, it's going to be weak, making it more prone to winter injury. So at least a site that receives at least 6 hours of direct sun would be best.
All right, let's get back to the phones. 866-780-9100. Rick is on the line. Hi, Rick.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I've got a English walnut tree, and the squirrels are taking them off left and right, and they're not really mature yet. And I just don't know how to deal with it, I guess. Should I take the nuts off myself now? Or usually the shell starts to come apart, and then they're ready.
Right.
But the squirrels aren't waiting for it.
They're impatient.
Well, and I'm not sure that. Well, I wouldn't pick them before they're mature because they really won't be edible. So, and it's very hard to discourage squirrels from doing that. How do they get into the tree? Do they strictly go up the trunk, or can they jump into the tree from a house or garage or another tree?
Yeah, they can jump in from everywhere.
So there's no way to really stop them. I was going to say, if it was by itself, you could put something on the trunk where they couldn't climb the trunk, but if they can jump in from a house or a or tree, you really can't do much of anything, unfortunately.
Okay, and so I should wait on the ones that they leave me, I guess. Huh?
Right, yeah. Because otherwise they're not going to be edible. So they really have to mature on the tree. They don't mature off the tree. So.
Yeah, getting a bunch of immature walnuts would just be a disappointment all around.
Right.
Yes.
And they won't sprout or anything in the future if I were to put them in the ground?
Well, they have to be mature before they'll sprout. That's the same thing. So they have to be mature in order to sprout. They also have to be mature in order to eat. So.
And squirrels are terrific at planting walnuts.
Oh, yeah,
trees.
They are. They do a good job.
Yeah.
And acorns.
But they're... Okay. I don't think they're going to wait for me. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Rick. And I certainly know we have black walnuts on our property, and the squirrels are great at spreading black walnuts around. Mm-hmm. Next up, Ann in Iowa City. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was so proud of myself this spring when I got all my flower beds mulched nicely with cedar mulch, mostly chips, and some of it was shredded. But then as I was watering, I would notice all these ants crawling up out of the mulch, and sure enough, I had carpenter ants not only outside, you know, I was providing all that habitat outside, and they were also inside, and the guy that came to help me with that, you know, talked about, you know, I was providing too much habitat to encourage carpenter ants to be at my home. So, you know, that was just such an unintended consequence of a well-intentioned effort, and I'm just wondering, you know, if you had any comment on that, or, you know, I'd like to keep mulching with cedar as opposed to not mulching. Or should I use something else? Or
well, I wonder if they're actually carpenter ants, because carpenter ants typically don't infest mulch, usually. They typically feed on a rotting tree log, or if you have a rot within a tree, they'll feed on that. But they don't really feed. That's where they make their home. They actually feed on other insects, but they make their home basically in rotting wood, somewhere they have where they have protection. And for me, a mulch typically is really not a very protected location. So I wonder if it might be some other ant, possibly. Ants are very, very common. They don't really harm plants. So I don't worry about carpenter ants too much, just unless they're in the house, because they will also make their home. If, for example, you have a water issue, maybe a leaky pipe, and the wood near that pipe is wet or moist, they might make their home there too, but they usually don't bother solid wood. It's usually rotting wood or moist wood. So the best way to prevent carpenter ants in the house is to make sure you don't have a water issue.
And I don't think having the mulch even outside will attract ants inside either. So
carpenter ants are very, very common in nature, so...
Yeah, you
so Anne should continue to be proud of herself.
I think she should. It should be. You did a great job of mulching, and that it probably was important this year, and you just happened to have a lot of ants around this year.
All right, Anne, I hope that makes you feel much better about your efforts. Next up, we'll go to John in West Des Moines. Hi, John.
Hi. What I have, I got a windbreak of Norway spruce. They're about 55 trees, and I planted them around 1980, so they're around 40 years old. They're 3 days, twos, and what I did, they're bare roots, so I used a tree spade, and I may have made three cuts across and then planted them, you know, and they all did fine, but lately, this year, I got like four of them. I got two rows, and they're planted around 16, I can't remember now, but if it's 16 feet across or between the rows and about 18 feet between the trees. So, but on the north side, I've lost probably, I got maybe three or four turned brown, and they're like 40 foot tall, or so not sure. And then on the south side, I got one dying. That's the first one I've had dying on the, they're just turning brown. Just this week, they started turning brown. And I noticed a couple years ago, I lost a couple, and on the north side, and it looked like they had some girdle on it, which kind of made me wonder if I had You know, I didn't know if another tree could have came across, girdled, or, you know, when you plant them dirt like that, maybe I had a root that girdled them. But otherwise, I know they don't like wet soil, so this is some of the soil is on the wet side, otherwise it's timber soil, and some of it isn't. And so we've been dry. I mean, we had quite a bit of rain, you know, around West Point, Iowa, but now it's dry on the dry side, but we've been real hot. So I don't know what's up with them. I just wondered if you guys would have it.
Yeah, I'm not
is
sure.
Anything going on around the state?
No. The Norway spruce is one of those trees we still recommend because it has relatively few problems. And so we don't see a lot of disease. We don't see a lot of insects on Norway spruce. So I'm not sure exactly what's going on. Other evergreens may have some problems, but Norway spruce are still quite reliable. I guess what you might want to do is maybe take some photographs and send those to our plant diagnostic clinic and see if they have some idea what's maybe going on. So I would take maybe one or two shots of a portion of the windbreak showing some of the declining trees or dying trees. I would take maybe two or three close-ups of some of the affected trees and send those to the clinic and see if they have any idea. Their email address is P as in plant, I as in insect, D as in disease, C as in clinic, at iastate.edu. But at this point, I don't think it has anything to do with the girdling of the roots. I'm not sure exactly what's going on. So pictures might be helpful.
Very good. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, John. Wayne is up next in Davenport. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Last week I had a large ash taken down in my yard. It had the ash borer in it, and I asked the arborist to leave a 6-foot stump upon which I would like to put a platform and build a nice treehouse for my grandchildren. It doesn't look like there's any disease down the core of the tree or on that particular part of it. My question is that going to be a suitable foundation if the ash borer, is the ash borer going to undermine that foundation and ruin that stump?
Well, if you kill the stump, then I don't think it's going to attract the insect because they wouldn't be able to feed on a dead tree. So if it's a dead tree, I don't think they're going to find it attractive because they feed the larvae feed on the tissue basically beneath the bark. And if that tissue is basically dead, I don't see them feeding on that, surviving on that. So if the actual stump is dead, I don't think it's going to attract the insect.
Oh, very good. Well, that'll be a good foundation for that treehouse.
All right. Sounds like
fun.
Thank
you very much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Wayne. Adam is on the phone next. A little bit of a change of pace with a question here. Hi, Adam.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, a bit of a different question is right. I am a student. I'm going to Iowa State this fall, and I'm going to be entering the horticulture field of greenhouse management.
Awesome.
I just finished up the associate's at DMAC. Yeah. So I was just kind of curious what you thought. I'm very passionate about just life sciences and everything and learning about the world and how it works. But I was just wondering if greenhouse management would be the correct degree for me. I'm just kind of looking towards a changing world in the future and adapting to the changes to the environment. Maybe any thoughts you may have on things I could go to in the agriculture field. I know agriculture business is also really big.
Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, coming to horticulture will kind of give you that kind of first chance to get a look at some of those things. At ISU, there's also entrepreneurship, which is a minor, and there's ag business, there's ag education and studies. All of these things can relate in environmental sciences and agronomy. There's lots of opportunities and lots of options. Starting in horticulture is great, especially if you're thinking of greenhouse, because that controlled environments is very popular with hydroponics right now and growing vegetables and edibles actually indoors. So I think
so you guys might be a little bit biased, but you feel like it's a good career pathway at this point.
I think it's a great career pathway, but it, you know, is it the right career pathway for Adam? And I think it's one of those things that you just try different things and you will find that right fit. Or and it may be a couple, combining a couple of things together.
All right. Well, good luck, Adam. Thanks for your call. Last call of the day, Margaret in Rock Island, Illinois. Hi, Margaret.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
I have boxwood shrubs, and my husband and I are having a dispute on how to prune those. I've read several things. One said to wait for the foliage to mature, which that's where we're at right now. And so he likes to shear it off. I've read that you should go in and do a little opening. He doesn't like that idea, so advise that I call you and see what you said.
I think we believe or would feel shearing is better for those.
Okay.
I feel that, at least.
Or hand pruning, just right. Kind of doing some regular right. Hand pruning instead of taking the electric shears. You can do a pretty good job of hedging.
Right, but they tolerate mm-hmm. shearing quite well, and you can do it now. I would do it as soon as possible, but I would make it a fairly light pruning or shearing at this point, and you can also prune them or shear them in early spring, like April. And if you want to prune them more severely, I would do so in April.
Okay, well, because we'd like to keep them, on the small side,
mm-hmm.
not let them get out of hand. So we'll do that. We'll prune lightly and then do it again in the spring when we can go maybe a couple inches down.
All right, Margaret, thanks a lot for your call. Here's an email question from Kim. She says, we have what farmers call wild pea vines. They have huge pods filled with what look like huge dandelion seeds in the fall. I pull them every day, but they persist. Any ideas on how to stop these in the future? I'm taking care to make sure none get big enough to have seeds this year.
I'm not sure exactly what that is. It might be the honey vine milkweed, possibly, which is actually a milkweed. It's also a weed. And it does produce a pod like you would see on a milkweed. Those are pretty hard to control. Repeated efforts, basically.
And preventing that seed from spreading
is absolutely
a huge part of that effort.
Yes.
All right. And do monarchs like this kind of milkweed?
I don't think so much.
Nope. Oh,
no,
bummer.
I was going to say maybe
she could just find the silver lining.
No, I don't think there's a silver lining here much.
Oh, bummer. All right. Well, stay at it. Here's a question from Bob. He says, I have tomato plants that are 6 feet tall searching for light. Ooh. Is it a bad idea to trim down the growth of the plants?
I would just leave it. It must be an indeterminate variety, but I would just let it grow as long as we have good weather and it's destroyed by a hard freeze.
Because it's still flowering
right.
And it's still potentially fruiting. So,
right.
Yeah, more tomatoes.
All right, and this is a question from Russ. He says, are old coffee grounds beneficial to garden plants like junipers, hostas, daylilies, etc.? What plants do they help? I will not make a compost pile for them.
then I would put them in the garbage in that case.
They are best if they're composted, and then they help everything. There are people who like to scatter them around roses or other things, but really it's, you know, that part of that composting process.
All right.
Sorry.
Well, it's good that he was upfront about it,
yes,
right?
Yes, this is awesome.
You gotta be honest from the get-go. All right. Are you guys headed back to the fair again, or are you done?
Tomorrow.
We're there judging tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
All right. Well, enjoy it. Beautiful forecast
yes.
for the Iowa State Fair. Richard Geron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Cindy Haynes, Associate Professor of Horticulture at Iowa State University. We will be back again next Friday with Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Have a great weekend.